Hello everyone and welcome once again to Motos and Friends, the weekly podcast brought to you by the editors at Ultimate Motorcycling Magazine. My name is Arthur Coldwells. This week, editors Don Williams and Nick DeSena discuss the latest addition to the Harley Icons collection, the 2024 Harley-Davidson Hydroglide Revival. This beautiful new softail commemorates the 75th anniversary of the hydraulic fork debuting on a Harley-Davidson. Don rode the Hydroglide Revival with his usual enthusiasm for all of these Icons collection bikes. And of course, he answers the big question, does the Hydroglide ride as beautifully as it looks? Fair warning, the second segment this week is going to be a bit controversial. Were you taught not to cover the brakes when riding? Were you taught not to brake on entry into a corner? Were you coached out of new rider training because you didn't grasp it quickly enough? Well, it seems that although new rider training is excellent in many regards, there are certain fundamentals being taught that are just plain wrong. At best, they're causing recently new riders to leave the sport, and at worst, these incorrect fundamentals are costing lives. This episode, Associate Editor TJ Adams chats with several people who recently attended new rider training to get their take. The main discussion is led by Nick Einach of Yamaha Champions Riding School, one of the several passionate voices trying to get things changed. Whether you think you've been taught correctly or incorrectly, this segment will be of interest to you. We need training groups, and indeed, the industry itself, to get behind this movement to evolve and improve these significant points. We need those with a passion to ride motorcycles to stick with it and not get put off and leave the sport. If you agree, please leave a comment on our social media or message us directly. Let's get the word out and make a positive change. So, from all of us here at Ultimate Motorcycling, we hope you enjoy this episode.
Okay, so this is Senior Editor Nick DeSena with the Moto and Friends podcast, and I'm joined with Editor-in-Chief Don Williams, who has just got done writing the 2024 Harley-Davidson Hydroglide Revival. So this is, you know, part of the could we call it the Icons collection that's been going off for the past couple of years, which includes the Electroglide Revival, the Electroglide Highway King. Isn't a lowrider El Diablo also in that category as well?
Yes, this is the fourth of bike in the Icons collection. And I have to say, I have loved them all. They've all been great bikes, really cool to ride, cool to take out. You know, they have varying degrees of modifications to them. They all get different paint look. That's the big difference, but they also get a few technical changes on each bike. And so the Harley-Davidson Hydroglide Revival, it's a quick read on what they've changed on this. Basically, they took the Heritage Classic 114, put some really cool paint on it, some extremely cool stinking badges, and they slammed the rear an inch, so that instead of 3 inches of rear wheel travel on the soft tail chassis, it's 2 inches on this, and that gives it a little bit more trail. And that's basically the change. So you have some cosmetics and you have a little bit of a different look to it because of the, you know, the drop rear end. And so I can tell you about riding it, which is that it's not a huge difference. Unless I rode them back to back, I probably wouldn't have been able to tell you that they had dropped the rear end an inch. I think that's more of something you see subtly and you don't really realize it when you see it. I didn't know that it had been dropped an inch until I saw the spec sheet. Now, somebody who's a Heritage Classic owner might immediately look at it and go, oh, wow, that they dropped the back an inch. But in my case, I didn't even notice that. The rear suspension is, you know, it's the soft tail, so it's not like the touring bikes. So it's not the super smooth ride anyway. So the fact that they went from 3 inches to 2 inches, really didn't make that much difference. and there's a little bit more trail. So on the freeway, out in the open highway, theoretically, it's, you know, a little bit more stable. Again, not something I noticed just out riding. It's something, though, that's it's there. So you get the, kind of the advantage of it without feeling like the bike's, you know, now not very agile or, you know, not easy to ride, or, you know, it's just a straight line thing. So before I get, you know, I want to go back to the riding, but before I get to that, I want to talk about the way it looks, because really, if you're buying this bike, it's because it looks cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to kind of dive into the Icons collection and sort of its purpose a little bit, because as I remember it, back in 21, they launched the Electroglide Revival, and that thing, you know, Harley's been doing a number of, let's say, limited editions that really kind of serve red meat to the masses. I mean, these things are appealing to that hardcore Harley Davidson fan. That it's interesting because in my mind, it hits a couple different audiences. You're going to be appealing to that older audience that may connect with it because that was something from their youth. Maybe that's something that some of these models, they had variations of in their garages as kids. You know, their parents are riding them. At the same time, you might be hitting that customer that really wants to connect with that bygone era of Harley Davidson, because the brand has evolved quite a bit over the years. And these particular models, the Hydroglide, the Electroglide, the Electroglide Highway King, and the Lowrider El Diablo, they all really lean into that classic American V-twin look. I mean, they're painfully old school, and I don't mean that in a bad way. So let's kind of get into the crux of it, because that's what these particular subset of Harley Davidsons are really about, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, we all know it's your opinion.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about the Hydroglide compared to the other three models that you mentioned, the other three models were late 60s, early to mid 70s kind of vibe. The Highway King and the Electroglide Revival, those two were very close in time. One was a Batwing fairing and the other one had the windshield, but they were only like a year or two apart in their concept. It was like late 60s and early 70s. The El Diablo Lowrider, which really did was a cool bike. Everywhere I rode it, people go, "Oh, look at that bike. Oh, that's cool." So that bike was more like mid to late 70s. The Hydroglide Revival moves into a totally different era. And the concept of it is it's the 75th anniversary of the first Harley Davidson with a telescopic fork. Instead of having a Springer front end, they went with just, you know, what we would consider to be a modern front suspension, which is the hydraulics, two tubes, you know, some oil inside and the spring and ready to go. And so this bike celebrates the 75th anniversary of moving on from the Springer. And let me say for 1 minute there is that I hope that next year we get one that's a Springer, because it's been a long time since Harley had a bike with a Springer front end. And I really like riding them. They're really cool. They look cool. I like the way they feel. They're not sporty, but they have a different feel that is really good. So maybe the Hydroglide is like a little hint that they're going to tap into the 50s. So when they did the design of the paint, it's not like a specific year like the Highway King was or the first Electroglide Revival. This one is like some of it's like 56, 57, other parts 55. They kind of mixed and matched a little, but you'd have to be a real hardcore historian to to see the differences. For me, you know, this is before even my time. You know, when I see this bike, it just looks cool. And I don't really care that this is the 56 paint job or the 57 badges on it. The bike looks cool.
So it's more of an amalgamation of the vintage styling from way back when, because you do have the old school style badging. You do have the actual full fender in the front, not just the half fender that's pretty traditional now on a lot of the touring bikes. And then you do have the one aspect that we should talk about here is, I feel like this is more of a 60s, 70s thing, but the What is the actual word for it? They're typically on chaps.
Well, to me, this is a 50s looking bike. It doesn't, it kind of looks a bit 60s because the 50s spread into the 60s with Harley Davidson. And this was the original FL. That was, you know, in the bikes, the 20 bikes are still called FLs. And it's worth reminding everybody, this is not a touring bike in the Grand American Touring category for Harley Davidson. This is a soft tail. So even though it has, you know, the side bags and it has a windshield, it's not the touring platform. It is a soft tail. And but that reminds us also that back then you didn't have those grand differentiations between the different models and of the Harley Davidsons. Every bike kind of did everything. You know, maybe you had a Sportster and then you had the big inch bikes eventually, and then they kind of worked into those two categories, but there wasn't so much these like big touring bikes and then these cruiser bikes. It was kind of all, you know, they were all mix and match.
And to kind of reiterate that point, the Sportster's name originally sort of nodded at the fact that it was supposed to be quote unquote sporty. And if you look at it through the lens of when the Sportster was actually released, that was true, not through a modern lens, of course, but back when the Sportster came out, way before my time, way before your time, that actually was a sport bike in the grand scheme of things. So yeah, you know, obviously definitions change, technology changes, things improve, and, you know, things march on. Related to that, the Softail Slim, do you know the differences between that? Because a lot of people are going to be pretty familiar with the Softail Slim and what we have going on here.
The seat is a little bit higher because of the longer, you know, the 1-inch longer travel suspension on the Heritage Classic, but it's that bike. You know, the Slim is more like a cruiser, kind of more aggressive looking bike. This is definitely relaxed, totally upright, high wide bars, windshield, three headlights. In this case, two-tone paint. You get red line red. I love that color. It wasn't enough to just say red line. You had to say red line red.
Yeah. And how is the finish, by the way, on it? I mean, when we're talking CVOs, that stuff is pretty gleaming. Is this up there? Because obviously it's part of the limited edition series, so I assume it's got to be pretty ritzy stuff.
Yeah, it looks super nice. I'm not a painter, so a painter would be better qualified than I would be to look at it and go, oh, well, they did this way or they did this that way. I can't address that from that level, or if you're really super picky about paint. But just, you know, when I walk up to it, it looks great. You know, it's not like the birch white part is a decal over red. You know, it's a two-tone paint job. You know, the red looks great. It all looks good. And as you know, the cruisers recent years have been moving towards blacked out. In fact, it's kind of interesting how they charge more for a blacked out look than for chrome these days. And in this case, this bike's got a lot of chrome. Chrome here, chrome there, chrome headlights on the headlights, chrome on the engine, chrome exhausts, chrome hub on, it's one disc. So on the other side, they have the bigger hub that kind of gives a little bit of a reminder of the look of a drum brake on at least one side. You know, chrome outers over the fork legs, chrome crash bars. A really cool, another change, they have a Screaming Eagle air filter cover that's chrome, the old school round one instead of the ones now that have, you know, square shape. This one's the old round, looks really cool. So there's chrome everywhere. And so that gives the bike, you know, a retro look to me, but a good retro look. I like the blacked out look, but I also like the chrome look. I don't feel like I have to choose between one or the other. They're both cool. And so it just kind of depends on how you want to present yourself.
No, it's about as authentic as you get in that case. Like, this is the classic, in my opinion. A bike like this represents that classic chrome American V-twin sort of nostalgia, which is becoming a bit of a novelty in the grand scheme. If you really look at, you know, Indian motorcycle offerings, Harley Davidson, et cetera, et cetera. So it is different by not necessarily being different, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that makes it, you know, another part of the thing that makes it stand out is it's got, you know, the leather fringe. It's got the conchos, which I had to look at, you know, it's not conchos, and I don't understand what they are. And then I kind of looked it up and I was like, oh, it's taken after conch shells. So it's kind of like a little look that's like, you know, a seashell. But the conchos, you know, they have all the fringe on those, and those are on the seat, the tank. There's one on the tank that kind of only you get to see because it's between your legs. And then there's three on each of the bags. And then below the bags on the lid, there's some more fringe. So when you're riding, there's like fringe flying all around. And, you know, fringe isn't for everybody. At least it's black fringe. So it, you know, it looks good. And I like it when I looked at the pictures afterwards when I'm, you know, going by and it's flying. It's like, yeah, that gives you that look of movement, and it's cool. There's like a seat cover that goes on the side, kind of that has, you know, more of the fringe. And also for chrome, we were talking about, there's a seat frame that goes on the outside. It's a solo seat, you know, so it just has that cool look. There's, you know, so there's that aspect of it too. That's the old school fringe look. Again, not for everybody, but if you like it, it looks, you know, it's great. And this is another one of those bikes, you know, I talk about this almost every time, but I go out and people are going, oh, that's a cool bike, or, oh man, I love that bike. And it's not like I go out and ask people what they think, you know, they come up to me, you know, or they lean their head out the window at a stoplight and point at the bike, go, ah, it's cool, you know. And it's an immediate positive, positive attention bike. It's not like I ever have somebody roll down the window and goes, man, that's an ugly bike, why are you riding that? You know, so it's just cool. And it, you know, it's got the fat wheels, you know, the other old school thing. And again, it's got the triple headlights, which are now LEDs, but I always ride with them all on, the three of them on, because I think that looks cool, you know. So it's like I have that. Oh, and another thing is the windshield, the top half of it's clear, but the bottom half is a translucent red line red. And they've used that look on previous Icon collection. On the first one, it was blue on the bottom half. And they had kind of a different color. I can't remember what it was now on the Highway King. So this is something like, I had somebody ask me, isn't that distracting? It's like, no. The only time it kind of just, it's low enough that it doesn't really get in the way of you seeing the road. But every time I look down on it, like if I'm looking at the speedometer, which also is cool, the speedometer, it doesn't have like 20, 30, 40, 50. It just has 2, 3, 4, 5, kind of like a tachometer. So, you know, you just kind of see it go. And it's just the single digits and the font they used. It just looks good. But anyway, so the colored bottom half doesn't intrude on anything. And also, and I didn't do this because it's wintertime, it was cold, but the windshield's quick release. You don't need tools or anything. You just yank on it and it comes off. You just, you know, kind of jam it on and it stays on. And so if you want to ride, like riding around town in summertime, you just pull that windshield off and you have a, you know, a pretty different looking bike, but still the cool retro look.
Yeah. So we've sort of covered the looks of it. And we also talked about the handling a bit and the suspension early on, but this does have the Milwaukee 8 114. So we've met the Milwaukee 8 114 a number of times. It's in quite a few bikes at this point. This is the standard or the base engine now, isn't it?
Yeah. It's funny. I go back to like days like the 88, and those bikes were kind of underpowered. And, you know, the latest, the 117 that you've ridden, it's in the Road Glide and the Street Glide, that bike, that is a lot more powerful than this one. No doubt about it. Cause those are even heavier bikes than this. And it's still, you know, and you can tell the difference that 117, cause it's not just three more cubic inches, but there's a lot more technology involved in that motor to make it, you know, a higher performer. But the 114 still has plenty of power, you know. And again, this is a solo bike, small bags, no top box, so you're not really carrying a lot of extra stuff on it. But, you know, when you comes time to get on the freeway, you just roll on the throttle and it hauls. You know, if you're at a stoplight and you want to get away first, you're getting away first, unless you have some really formidable competition. So the 114, although it's the lowest end, you know, big inch Harley these days, it's a big inch Harley still, and there's, you know, tons of torque. You know, what is it, 119 foot pounds? Some insane number. Yep, 119 foot pounds at 3,000 RPM. Like, you're barely off idle, and you're just grunting and, you know, running down the road. I mean, it's always interesting. The Harley, you know, this has 94 horsepower at 4,750 RPM, and anybody that rides like a big sport bike or a big sport touring bike is going to, you know, scoff at that number. But really, the torque is the number that matters. And unless you're just talking about, you know, how it works, let's say 110 or 120 miles an hour, where this bike isn't going to be happy, you know, isn't going to really push farther than that. But boy, when it comes to acceleration, that torque just kicks butt. And that the bike is super fun to ride, super easy to ride. The, you know, there's no power modes on this. There's no traction control. It does have cruise control, but the, you know, no cornering ABS, just one front disc. It was very bare bones, certainly from a touring aspect. And if I was touring on it, it's every time, it's kind of a bummer for me. Every time I get like a Heritage Classic, I always think I'm going to go some trip. You know, to me, when I look at a Heritage Classic or I look at the Hydroglide Revival, I look at it and I just want to ride across the country, you know, just like old school, just like when people would take whatever bike they had, throw a windshield on it, and they would go across the country. And that was just a normal thing. You know, you might do it. I mean, in the 1960s, Honda had a Bentley 125 touring bike. It had a four-stroke 125 that people used for touring, you know? So you'd think, okay, I have this 114 cubic inch bike, be good for touring. But every time I get on it, I'm always disappointed in that the bike's not smoother than it is. And this has been true of every single Heritage Classic I've had going back to the beginning. There's always this like kind of hit of the engine. Instead of it being like a rumble, there's this like kind of where it's, I don't want to say it's hammering your hands and your feet, because your butt doesn't feel it. It's just your hands and your feet. But just a little bit more impact there than massaging. And it always makes me think, do I really want to put, you know, 1,000 miles on this bike doing that?
So do you think that's a counterbalancing thing? Because I think I know what you're talking about. I think in a, you know, because I've ridden the 114s. When Milwaukee 8 came out, we started at, what was it, 107? Now we're up to 121 at the maximum. But I can definitely see how, you know, some of the road glides and street glides, some of the larger touring bikes that just have more stuff bolted onto them can start damping those sensations that you might see. It'll actually mask some of that stuff. Whereas this is a pretty stripped down motorcycle, and it might be giving you a little bit more raw feedback than you had anticipated. Now, I'm not sure if that's the case necessarily.
Oh yeah, that's the case. And like I said, it happens every time. And I think it's part of it's just the Softail chassis transmits vibration different than the touring chassis. And so if you like that feel and you want that feel, the, you know, where the bike vibrates, it's great. And there are people, I mean, I know people that ride from LA to Sturgis on hard tails. You know, I am not that tough of a guy, but they would feel like this bike, and they go, oh, this bike doesn't vibrate at all. You know, it's just, we ride a lot of different bikes. We have experience with the different kinds of Harley Davidsons. And so compared to the touring bikes, this bike feels rough, you know, and again, that's either a feature or a bug, depending on your personality. I mean, there's plenty of people who would say, oh, I like the feel of this when I'm riding it. I feel like I feel the engine is alive. It's this living thing, not this glide that's just, you know, going down the road and you don't even know the engine's on. And so, you know, especially if you have that feeling that you want to have that visceral feel. So it's just something for people to think about when they're buying a bike, like what exactly do they really want? Do they want the smooth tour? Or they have to go into the world of the street glide and the road glide. If they want a bit more of the, you know, old school feeling, this gives it. There's more vibration. The windshield does not give anywhere near the same kind of protection as the fairings on the Road Glide and the Street Glide, you know, there's a lot more turbulence. It's still good. I mean, I rode the Highway King, which just had a windshield, all the way to see my dad, you know, more than 1,000 miles round trip, no problem. So the windshield is good, but it's not, doesn't offer nearly the civilization aspect that the big touring bikes fairings have. And around town, the bike's great. You know, you don't even notice any of this stuff. The vibration is irrelevant. And, you know, especially if you're moving up and down through the rev range, like even if you're in the canyons and stuff riding around, you don't notice that vibration. It's more of a thing you notice when you're at a fixed speed, and it just starts to, you know, it's the same hit over and over and over again. So, you know, that's what you get with this bike. You get the old school look, you get kind of an old school visceral touring bike feel, and what you get with the Heritage Classic, but this kind of accentuates it all. Again, shorter suspension, a little bit rougher ride, you know, just it's all there for the person who's looking to move back into the 50s without having a bike that they have to work on all the time. You know, you still get all the modern, you know, reliability and performance, because, you know, this bike has 50% more horsepower than the first FL had, the real Hydro Glide.
Yeah. Outside of the chassis and the suspension and the fueling and, you know, we can go down the rabbit hole in terms of why vintage bikes on the surface look very cool, and they should definitely be preserved, which is why, you know, the Barber Vintage Motorcycle Museum is one of the most interesting things that we have in the United States for motorcycles. But the prospect of actually riding some of those older bikes is a bit dubious, in my opinion. So,
right. I totally agree. There's a reason we've moved forward over all these years. And this bike, you know, is I would rather ride this than the original FL anytime. I might want to hop on an FL and ride around the block, but I would rather own a Hydro Glide Revival. So it's a cool bike. And I don't think that, you know, if you go into it eyes wide open, understanding exactly what you get as far as the touring aspect of it, you'd be completely satisfied.
Yeah. So what are we looking at in terms of price, and how does that compare to the bike that it's based off of?
Yeah, this is $25,000. And I think it's a $1,500 premium over the most expensive flavor of the Heritage Classic. So, you know, if you got the most expensive Heritage Classic set up, and then you do, it's just $1,500 more than that. So, I mean, if it were me and I was interested in Heritage Classic, I would buy this, because this is a kind of a version of the Heritage Classic. I would buy this immediately. I wouldn't even think about it. But that's because the way it looks works for me, you know. So if somebody else wants a bike that's black and doesn't want fringe, you know, they have that option. So, but for me, for the extra, you know, $1,500, there's no doubt that what you get is worth it if you like the way it looks.
Yeah, that's a bit of a gimme at $1,500 if you're definitely leaning into the old school, which is kind of what you're going after if you're aiming at the Heritage Classic kind of stuff. Anyway.
Exactly.
That's you know, that kind of sounds like we've hit all the P's and Q's for the 2024 Harley Davidson Hydro Glide Revival.
Always fun talking about motorcycles.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Bye.
Take care.
Fair warning, the second segment this week is going to be a bit controversial. Were you taught not to cover the brakes when riding? Were you taught not to brake on entry into a corner? Were you coached out of new rider training because you didn't grasp it quickly enough? Well, it seems that although new rider training is excellent in many regards, there are certain fundamentals being taught that are just plain wrong. At best, they're causing recently new riders to leave the sport, and at worst, these incorrect fundamentals are costing lives. This episode, Associate Editor TJ Adams chats with several people who recently attended new rider training to get their take. The main discussion is led by Nick Einach of Yamaha Champions Riding School, one of the several passionate voices trying to get things changed. Whether you think you've been taught correctly or incorrectly, this segment will be of interest to you. We need training groups, and indeed, the industry itself, to get behind this movement to evolve and improve these significant points. We need those with a passion to ride motorcycles to stick with it and not get put off and leave the sport. If you agree, please leave a comment on our social media or message us directly. Let's get the word out and make a positive change.
So I was speaking with a chap called Ray Hammonds, and we did a podcast. He's a really interesting guy. And we were talking about motorcycle training for newbies. He's a mature new rider. And we were talking about how what you're taught to pass your test isn't necessarily the safest and best way to ride a motorcycle. We spoke about Yamaha Champ School and the sort of things he'd learned there. So I wondered if you'd got any insight into differences and if you'd noticed anything between new riders coming to you to sort of top up their training and what they're doing to be safe, what you're teaching them, and I suppose why a lot of new riders, because I spoke to a few other people after Ray about this subject, just because it piqued my interest, you know, why new riders suddenly get put off and sell their bikes and their gear and everything and stop riding.
Yeah, because I can't tell you how many times we've heard from our students. They literally stop the class and they say, why did I learn the opposite at my new rider school, the opposite of what you're teaching? And we do these after action reports. We ask every Marine who comes to our level 3 training to give us feedback. They answer a sheet and then they're allowed to make comments. And TG, I've got stacks of comments from these Marines, and so many of them are literally upset. I learned the wrong thing. I was taught the wrong thing at the new rider school that was put on for me. And now that I've come here, I am really upset about it. I mean, when a Marine gets upset, he or she is pretty aggressive about it. And they were really frustrated with what they had learned. And then when they came to our school, the difference, and it's not that we were right or wrong. It's just that the bike worked better. The safety factor went up. That's the main thing. The bike control safety factor went up. Especially in the two places we're dying, which is intersections, number one place for crashing and running wide in corners. So definitely. And specifically, there's some specific issues there that the Marines learned. And I'm talking about the Marines because we survey them all. I also, of course, speak to, you know, every graduate, every school student that comes to the school. We speak to them about whatever they want to talk about. And so many of them are saying, man, I've learned the wrong thing. My kids learned the wrong thing. I was taught literally the opposite of what you've taught me, and I feel the difference. And you're nodding your head because you also came to the school and felt some of the little things that we do improve bike control.
Yes, that's why I've chosen to speak with you, because that's what I learned, different things. I learned about being allowed to keep the brake on, for instance, when you are going through a curve, which was previously a no-no for me. I was told to get everything over with before you enter the curve and, you know, sort of wing it all the way around, which now I realize how out of control I was.
That's right. And I mean, students have said, I don't know how I've survived this long without knowing these things. And to speak specifically to this, I was at Camp Pendleton, and I spoke with the head traffic motorcycle training officer person. And he worked for several new rider companies. And I said, hey, Dave, what's the number one reason you think Marines crash? And he said, oh, it's a lack of judgment. I thought, okay, the people who are flying our helicopters and jets and fixing helicopters and flying drones and doing all these things, they have a lack of judgment.
Yes, that's not what you wanted to hear.
No. And of course, I walked away from the conversation because I knew it's a specific issue. And remember, your judgment is based on what you know. So if your judgment includes what you had heard, get all your braking done in the straight line, set your entry speed before the corner. And then when you fail to do that, you have bad judgment, when in fact, the motorcycle is designed to steer into the corner with the brakes on. And I say that not because I'm Mr. Know-it-all, and I want to really make sure people who are listening to this understand that. It's not that you know, I believe this or I believe that. It's just that we really work hard at who designed the motorcycle, what inputs were designed to make it work. And so turning in to the corner with your brake light on, just simply put it as that. So brake pressure on, tipping in past the corner, past the corner entry, past the turn in point. That does three things. One, it helps control your speed further down in the corner. So if the slowest part of the corner is later than the tip in, which it always is, or if the corner tightens, pick your excuse. Number one, it controls your speed in the corner. Number two, it controls your steering geometry. When you pull the brakes on, when you roll off the throttle, the weight goes forward, rake and trail numbers tighten, bike wants to turn better, pull on a little bit of brake, it works even better, and you can control it better. So you control your steering geometry into the corner, and magically the bike works because the designer's always steered in with the brakes on. And third, it controls that front contact patch. As you roll off, weight goes forward, the contact patch spreads out, you pull on some brake, it spreads out even more, and now you can tip in with that contact patch spread out. And that's why, you know, you went truly, I mean, you told me you went from a rider who was kind of nervous all the time to someone who now you really enjoy riding, right? You look forward to getting on the bike. Is that
that's
fair?
Right. Yes. Yeah. I was an extremely anxious rider. Like, I would get sick the night before. I knew we were all going out on a ride. If it was in a group, I'd always feel I was going to sort of be the weakest link and kind of dangerous to everybody else. Not quite dangerous, but, you know, it made me very anxious. Yes. But I felt once I'd done my new learner's course that I'd got more control on my speed going into the corners, but still I had no knowledge. Everything you've just explained about the way the motorcycle works and how you need to build your speed, apply the brakes to keep safe and keep them on until, you know, it's necessary to ease off of them. And even the easing on and off, none of that was taught, you know, how to brake into it gently using 5% of the brake to avoid, and really think about that, because it makes sense once you're told, but to think about it so that you don't get that abrupt control going into the machine.
Exactly. And none of this is earth shattering. It's all small little pieces. You know, it's just literally for you, in your case, it was to leave your brakes on 10 more feet, 15 more feet. And those little changes, that's what makes all the difference. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you could say that this person who told me that the Marines have bad judgment, he could get upset at people for going in the corner too fast. And he would get upset at people, and he'd say, you have bad judgment. And he would ridicule them personally, when in fact they were working with an incorrect concept, which is to get all your speed set before the corner entry. It's a great theory, and it's wonderful if you do it. It's fine. It's actually not very good because you're off the brakes before you turn. But let's say you're slowing down for the corners and you're making the corners. It's a totally doable thing. But someday you'll pop over the hill on a corner on a road you've never seen before, down into a right-hand corner. And when you get there, it goes to the left and it's 10 miles an hour. And some kid stole the sign that said 10 miles an hour. And all of a sudden you're in too fast. So now you run wide in this 10 mile an hour left-hand corner because you have poor judgment. No, because you're not using the brakes all the way down into the slowest point of the corner. And that's the problem, TJ. It's when things change, when you're riding your buddy's ZX14R that accelerates unbelievably well, and it's going 20 miles an hour faster on the same road with the same throttle input, and all of a sudden you approach that corner 20 miles an hour faster and you are told to get off the brakes before you steer, and it is deadly. And that's a big reason that you're having so much fun. It's why the Marines were so upset. It's why Ray Hammonds, what has he bought, oh, now 100 motorcycles now, because he learned, hey, we've got to ride the bike as designed.
Ray Hammonds, who was on our podcast last week, gave me this example.
So we have this crazy turn down this road called Sleepy Hollow here. And it's kind of a blind spot. And coming across the blind spot was a F-350 with lawn mowing equipment. And he was across the yellow line and just rolling my fingers off of it, coming up to it. I was able to miss the truck. If I would have, in my perception of what I learned at MSF class, if I would have done what they had said, I would have probably been an emblem on an F-350. In the middle of the turn, I would have had to have throttled the motorcycle because I had slowed, pressed, and I was looking. So I would have had to go back through the throttle.
Oh, I see. So you'd have been going along in the way you've been taught at the new learner school, and you wouldn't have been prepared to brake.
Right. I would have been going to the throttle at the worst possible time.
Right.
It would have set me up it would have made the bike run straight like it's supposed to. And I would have been adding throttle at the worst possible time.
So there you go. That was a real life example. Now let's get back to Nick Einach.
Really, for people who are, I'd like two people to be listening to this. One is that person who was a little bit like you, scared out of it, not really looking forward to riding, doing it maybe because, you know, someone around them wants them to do it, et cetera, and realizing there's a whole new world out there for you. I mean, it's game changing. It's just like, it's like a light switch that can go off once you realize, boy, the bike is designed to be ridden a certain way. And so you talk about, okay, brakes past the tip and going in, and then nobody talks about neutral throttle. At neutral throttle, which means enough throttle the bike holds its speed, the radius stays the same. So you're in the corner and you go to neutral throttle and you wait there at neutral throttle until the corner opens up, and then you accelerate. Because there's a new rider group that teaches slow, look, press, counter steer, that's fine, and roll on the throttle. So they're teaching people to roll on the throttle, accelerate the bike through the corner. And the number one place for dying is running wide in corners. And because when you accelerate a motorcycle, forks extend, the bike is designed to run wide. It doesn't matter how long you've ridden. If you dirt tracked, it doesn't matter what your skill level are. You could be a brand new rider. You could be a 40-year veteran, but your bike will run wide as we accelerate. So what we teach, what we taught you, what we teach is we do not accelerate the bike until the corner is opening. So in those two small little relatively detailed ideas, brake past tip until you're happy with speed and direction, neutral throttle, wait. When the corner opens, accelerate. Those are the things that we're so pushy about getting into new rider training, because it literally hurts people and it's being taught incorrectly.
Yes, I mean, I just spent my time wondering why everybody else was able to cope with the bend, shall I say, and enjoy them. When I wasn't, for me it was like straight roads, fine. Oh no, here comes a bend.
right. How are you now about them?
I love the bends. You know, the challenge, I'm just improving myself little by little every time, and I get lots wrong, but at least I feel safe because I'm halfway around the bend and I still have control.
Yeah, the best riders have a skill set to make mistakes. Freddie Spencer, you know, world champion, who I worked for 12 years, he said, I'll make a mistake at corner entry, but by the apex, by the closest you come to the inside of the corner, it's all fixed. And that's how we feel now. So it's you just said, I'll get lots wrong, but I'm still in that safety margin because we've got our brakes and we're not going to accelerate for any other reason. Then we can see the exit and take away lean angle. The second group I'd like to be listening to this is the industry, you know, the industry. And we did a little industry day that you attended with Arthur and Mitch Bame and a couple of the Bridgestone people, Road Racing World, said Michael Gugis. And we just said, hey, y'all may not be aware of what's being taught to new riders, because there's been a couple of meetings like, hey, industry, let's have a big meeting. Come on in here. Everybody sit down around the table. Why is motorcycling after COVID, why is it not growing? And oh gosh, interest rates are too high. Okay. Women's clothing is too expensive. Okay. New rider, there's not enough new rider bikes. That's possible. There's risk. People don't want to take risks anymore. Okay, that might be possible. So they had this meeting and they talked about all these ways to grow the industry. What are the problems in the industry? And they didn't invite us or Jason Pridmore or Jason DeSalvo or Josh Hayes or these top level motorcycle riding instructors. They didn't invite them to say, hey, new riders aren't learning the right things. In fact, they're learning things that hurt them badly. Their new riders are taught to not cover the brake, to ride like this.
Yes.
And there's a couple of reasons they're taught that, and we can discuss those if we want to. But now you're riding like this. Now you're a half second or so away from brake pressure. And of course, during that half second of the emergency, your bike is hurtling toward whatever is pulled out in front of you, a deer, a truck or a bus, whatever it is. So you're riding like this through traffic. Something pulls out in front of you, you're a half second away from it. So we would teach covering, and we would teach it in a way that would make it safe on the range and everything else. So those are the things that the industry needs to hear, because new rider training is not working well. And I have to counter people saying all the excuses like kids don't want to take risk. My friends who run new rider schools are sold out with a waiting list. They've got people lined up paying $250 to $500 to take the courses, but it's not transferring into people who buy bikes, get licenses, buy tires, leathers, all the things that our industry wants. So I hope the industry has a chance to listen, certainly talk with me, talk with my group about what to do, because if we cannot retain our new members, then the industry will not grow. And we're not doing a good job retaining them because they get done with, you know, a couple nights of school, some online courses, 2 days in a parking lot, which on a range, which should do it. And they leave there going, you know what? I'm not good at this because in fact, it is not an easy way to ride a motorcycle in some of the details that these new rider groups teach.
Well, I've experienced new riders falling off because I belong to quite a few groups, ladies groups, and we're in a safe space and able to put all sorts of questions on posts, etc. So I hear all the questions. I hear people who've, you know, grabbed their brakes, fallen off and going, that's it, I'm no good at this, I'm not riding again. Of course, we're always very encouraging and sort of talk them through it into trying again and go and ride with them and all that sort of thing. But it does come back to what they're being taught in the first place in order to take their test, in order to get on the road. And then they get on the road and that's when they get put off.
Exactly. And you can say, well, there's advanced training from these new rider groups, but I think less than 1% or somewhere around 1 or 2% of the people who take the new rider school, which is the license waiver school, you pass the school, you get your license, come back to more training. So they may never hear the message they should hear. And it's funny because it's easy to think, boy, Nick's going to stand up here and throw stones at new rider schools. But in fact, we are a MSF, Motorcycle Safety Foundation, Tier 3 school, the only one in the world, because I invited Ray Oaks, the MSF guru, to come to our school. And he came to the school and hung out and watched and said, okay, you guys will be Tier 3 MSF. And that was years ago. And from that Tier 3 designation, I felt we are going to work on this together. We're going to improve everything based on some of the things that we can bring in. And it never happened.
Yes. Yeah, so what you're teaching needs to be taught across the board to every new rider.
Yeah. And riders, you know, everybody out there that's thinks I'm full of it. The problem is that a new rider can buy any bike they want in the country and they can ride on any road they want in the country. So I really have to fight against that argument that this is an advanced technique or the new rider doesn't need to know this, because they can buy a Hayabusa when they graduate and they can ride in the Rocky Mountains the day after they graduate. So I do believe we have to fill them with the right information. And here's what's happened. We do this Young Presidents Organization group a couple times over the years. And it's this group that shows up. They've never ridden a motorcycle. So they are brand new riders. So we work with brand new riders. We walk them through our process of what we think a new rider should hear and learn. Got them started in the parking lot. By the end of the day, they're riding around the racetrack, which of course is a very safe place to ride. So the skills can be taught in 8 hours, in probably 6 hours, really, when you look at all the time of it all. So we had them ride around the racetrack, no crashes, had a great time. Totally converted riders. So that's one thing. The second thing I think is more important. We joined up with WMST, Washington Motorcycle Safety Training. And that is a group run by Chris, Kevin, Mike up there in Washington State. And Chris is a British Englishman. And he came to the States and saw rider training. And he was upset about it as we are. Like, wow, that is not working. That is not a smart way to do it. And so he runs new rider programs in Washington State. And we got together with E, Mike, and Kevin, his top guys, and we fashioned a new rider curriculum at WMST based on YCRS principles, champions' habits, and how the bikes are designed to be ridden, how the best riders in the world ride. And they are putting on, we're about eight months into the whole experiment. After 1 year, we will publish the results of crashes, pass-throughs, licensing. So what I'm saying is, I'm not just throwing stones at this whole program. I'm saying, let's get together with a group, WMST, let's fashion a program based on what a new rider needs to hear about traffic and all those other things and riding technique. So their expertise, our expertise combined, and we'll have results. But right now the results are out of this world improvement. And so it's doable, because some of the rider coaches out there might be thinking, boy, Nick, you got a great idea, but we can't fit that into our program. And I will say it's because the program's not quite right. The program has to be revised in certain ways with priorities placed on. Truly, the priorities have to be where people are dying, running wide in corners and in intersections. So if those aren't the priorities of the school, you may not have a very good school. And as I review New Rider schools, there are almost no priorities. Everything is kind of the same. And I'd like to change that format to get those priorities correct. And WMST is doing it. We're going to have all the results soon. It's out of this world. And it's just a chance for us to say, you know what? We're not standing on top of a mountain bitching about things. We're saying, let's get together and do it. Let's put it together. And the results so far are very, very strong.
You've identified where people are dying, the most accidents and where people are dying, and you've addressed it with the WMST. So that's kind of most of the way there. And so now here in the USA, it's time for things to change and just be updated. Is that so difficult?
Apparently it is. Apparently it's very difficult. It's very political. It's a lot of people have a vested interest in the way they do things. And I just want to tell anybody who wants to improve motorcycling in the country, we need to make new rider training two words, best practices. And that's all we work on at YCRS, best practices. And I've got these amazing instructors who you've met. And when they have an idea, if it works better than the current program, we change it. We keep tweaking on it. We keep saying, oh, this is better. This is better. Oh, not as good. Let's go back. So we keep on working on best practices. So if we would just get that idea, let's go to best practices in new rider training in America. It's got to turn that great big ship around. But I thought that we would do it when we came a tier three school. Keith Culver, one of the owners of YCRS, head instructor, one of the lead instructors, he has joined the SMSA, which is one of the groups that worked with states to fix their questions on their tests, to make the questions on the tests a little bit better. Because sometimes the new riders groups have to teach to what the state is asking in the test, which is a backward way of doing it. So they should work with them. But Keith went to another new rider training group and found the same problems, not covering the brakes, accelerating through the corner, set your entry speed before you turn in, same problems. So if we can look at best practices, just say, you know what, we don't care whose idea it is, let's not hang on to our ideas. Let's say, let's do whatever's best. And there's a saying, if I'm wrong, I want to be wrong for the shortest time possible. And we've been wrong for a long time in new rider training, and it's provable, TJ. That's the thing, it's provable. And that program you went to 2 weeks ago at Las Vegas Motor Speedway, we just put Keith on a bike in the rain and proved the things that were right and wrong. We proved that accelerating a motorcycle opens its radius at the same lean angle. And so it's totally provable. And I do believe that if anybody who wants to work in this industry, and to me, it's my whole life. You know, it's where I met my wife. My best friends are racers. I have 30 motorcycles. You know, this is my whole life. This is truly where I make my money. It's where I have my friendship. It's where I have my passion and my love. It's my getaway. And people who are not improving it are on my enemy list. We need to improve it. We need to say, let's make this available to all riders in the right way.
Yeah, well, I'm with you. There's no money in this for you. It's just a case if you want to stop new riders being put off riding and you don't want people to be dying where it's not necessary.
It's funny how many letters and phone calls, emails I get. People don't understand. You know, when I've been in the industry, as long as I've been in there, started at Motorcyclist in 84, started writing about this stuff and started, you know, went road racing based on my friendships with national and world champions. I've been in this a long time. And so I hear about everything. I hear about the sons crashing because they were taught rear brake only incorrectly by the coach that was there. And the thing that I'm getting to is this coaching out program. Have you heard about this?
No, what's that?
Okay, so coaching out is something that coaches can do at these new rider schools. They can take a student and bring them in to the office or whatever and say, you know what, this is not a sport for you. You should not ride, and you'll go home now. It's called coaching out.
But aren't they there to coach them?
That's the problem. They're coaches, and so they should coach them. And I can speak to this very clearly because there's four people that I know of very solidly that had been coached out, but they had the kind of personality that said, you know what, I really want to do this. This is my dream. And one of them is a gentleman named Diego back in New Jersey, went to a license waiver school. Coaches saw that he couldn't downshift. And rather than coach him or even tell him to come back or work with him over lunch, which is in the curriculum of the New Rider School, work with them, work with them. They said, you know what, you're not good at this. And then he'll go home. And so he went home and he called me, and I was driving the van home from Willow Springs Raceway with a van full of instructors. And Diego called me up in tears. He said, I've already bought a bike. I had a bike delivered to my house. I have a little 750 Yamaha, and I want to ride motorcycles.
Well, I managed to get hold of Diego. We had a chat, and here's what he had to say.
Right from the get-go, they said, okay, we took attendance. Let's go, and we'll start teaching you. We'll take you to the motorcycles. We'll choose a motorcycle for you, and then we'll start teaching you the controls. And then after that, they pushed us, and they made us go and start balancing, being able to balance the motorcycle on our own. That was also good. I would say those two exercises alone, they probably took 30 minutes teaching us that. So after that, they already wanted to be able to start the motorcycle and go on first gear and start riding the motorcycle on first gear. So in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to do it. And then I would always stall the bike. So I was struggling. And then I'm going to say 40 minutes into trying, one of the coaches comes and tells me, hey, listen, it seems like you're having trouble getting the motor, starting the motorcycle and putting it on first gear. I think this is not for you. Maybe you might want to try something else. So when he was telling me that, I probably say it was 7 in the morning, 8, like 8:40 in the morning. So I'm like 1 hour and 30 minutes into the course. So the instructor says, have you ever ridden a motorcycle before? And I said, no, you know, this is my very first time. This is why I signed up for the course, thinking that you guys not only will tell me, but also teach me and show me how to ride a motorcycle. So then he said, yes, we are doing that, but it seems like you're having more trouble than all the other guys here that already got it. And we feel like you're holding up the class behind, and we have to keep moving ahead. And unfortunately, I feel like this is not for you. Maybe you might want to try a different hobby or something like that, because again, you're holding up the class. And I was like, well, can I at least stay and watch? So then maybe the next time I come, I will know what steps I should be preparing for beforehand. That way I have an idea. And they said, no, we are not liable for you to stay here. In fact, we need you to sign some documents, because this will show that you weren't proficient in exercises 1 and 2. And as soon as you sign those documents, you would have to leave. And I said, well, in that case, I'm only 1 hour and 30 minutes into the course. Is there a way where I could try and come back another day, another weekend, or get a refund? And they said, no, we don't do refunds, because we're all booked and we're not going to have a space for you in the future. So this is, like I said, this is something that is not for you, and you should try to get some, you know, look into something else. So I was pretty bummed about that. I'm leaving the course, the facility, 1 hour and 30 minutes in, and I felt like I was, realistically, I felt like I was scammed, because I paid $375 for that course.
So that's a sad story about the New Rider School. I'm really disappointed to hear that, and it's embarrassing on behalf of all motorcyclists, really.
So I said, well, why don't we just get you one of my coaches who lives in the area to come work with you? Worked with him for 2 Saturdays. Now Diego's riding. He's going to do track days. He's bought more motorcycles. He's bought more gear. And then there's a woman in Las Vegas who got coached out, but she's going to stick with it. So can you imagine anybody in the industry? Can you imagine? Are you listening to me? If this is your job, and people are being told to quit riding, they paid $250 to $500, They took a couple of nights of their life to study the online courses. Then they spent 2 days. They planned to spend 2 days at a school. So they already invested. They already showed what Kenny Roberts said was the most important thing, and that is desire. They showed the desire to become a writer. And somebody at a new writer school said, you can't do this. Go home. And a lot do go home. Yes, but these four that I've just started noticing. And then I heard just kind of a third person that coaches are proud of the people they coach out. They tell their friends, yeah, I coached out another person today, as if that was a mark of pride. So I'm kind of beside myself on that particular subject, because all the classes that I've done, I did Willow Springs for 2 years teaching schools, Freddie Spencer for 12, YCRS since 2008. We have never coached out a person. And you can imagine how we've had some very poor riders, but we've said, you know what? They showed the desire to come here. Let's work with them. And we do. We work with them. And I mean, we put them on the back again. We take them out in the parking lot. We put them on a mini bike. We really work with them. And so, TJ, this breaks my heart for these people who will probably never listen to this. They've probably gone off and done something else now, and we lost them. So I'm really upset about that particular aspect of new rider schools.
Yeah, that's shocking. Mm. It sounds as though that's something to do with the statistics, maybe, for the school. They'd rather tell somebody they're unable to ride and have them not take part in the course because they have course pass rates, I guess, to achieve. I'm not sure. I'm just throwing that out there. It's a life changer. I mean, it's a big step. Like you say, having the desire is fantastic, but then you normally, if you're not from a motorcycle family, and by then somebody would have probably put you on a bike, you've got to persuade friends and family that you will be safe and you'll do a course and you'll get all the gear, and then you're told you can't ride.
Heartbreaking. And I know I was not a good motorcycle rider when I started. I mean, I rode a dirt bike terribly. I mean, just terribly. But my dad didn't say, okay, that's not for you. Get off that thing. He was patient, worked with me, and I started studying, listening to the best people, Keith Code, that type of thing. I started really thinking, realizing, boy, there's ways to do this. And I think that's one of the things that anybody who hears this as a rider needs to realize. There are true processes to the sport. And I'll bet you money one of your processes is wrong. I bet you're picking up the throttle when the best in the world are still slowing their motorcycle. I bet your initial brake pressure is four times quicker than the best in the world. So there are processes to it. And for those who are in charge of any of this new rider stuff, man, to coach out, you are killing our industry. You're killing the place where I not only make my living, which is one thing, but have my passion and my best friends and my best times. The best times in my life, apart from family, is on motorcycling. So, you know, we need to fix these things. It's not a big fix. It's an evolution of the programs that are being taught in new rider schools. But the problem is these small little things that are wrong get bigger at speed. That's the problem. A half second late to the brake lever, because you're not taught not to cover, half second late to the brake lever at 40 miles an hour is maybe a car length. You times that out to 100 miles an hour because you're enjoying your motorcycle when the deer jumps over the, now you're into hundreds of feet of getting the bike on the brake lever. So these things come faster, get worse with speed. Letting go of the brakes at minor brake pressure is a slower fork rebound. Letting go of the brakes before you turn at big fork pressures, big brake pressures, the bike rebounds so quickly, it wants to go straight, much less try to make the corner. So that's the problem, is we are allowed to buy big bore Harley-Davidsons, Hayabusas, R1s. We're allowed to buy all these FJRs, all these fast motorcycles, yet the training that we get for the fast motorcycle is wrong. Because if it's wrong on a small bike, it's really wrong on a fast bike.
I was recently at AIM Expo in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I spoke with Gary Sargent Sr. and Jr. from Sargent's Motorsports, which is a dealership in Portland, Oregon. They told me they'd heard similar experiences from new riders.
We had have a customer that we service as Harley-Davidson, because when he takes it to a Harley store, they charge twice as much as we do, okay? So his wife got tired of riding on the back of the bike. So she takes her Team Oregon class, and they put her on a little 125 motorcycle, or a 200 Yamaha TW200.
Yes.
And so she passed the course. He takes her down and buys a brand new Sportster, puts her on that. They're riding out the highway to I-205 freeway. And of course, he was way ahead of her. So he went off to the side and waited for her. And here she comes. And instead of pulling in on the clutch and the brake and doing what you got to do, she accidentally hit the throttle, went down a ravine and through a cyclone fence. She'll never ride a bike again. Right. She was on a bike that she should never have been on. She should have started out on a 250cc bike.
Yeah, that's shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hearing stories like this, and it's just piqued my interest to kind of find out.
So, yeah.
Why new riders are put off? I mean, what sort of...
And as he says, I don't want that rider to be scared, because it's one of two things that are going to happen. They're going to get scared, not ride again, or be like, oh my gosh, and continue on. Majority is I see them get scared and like, it happened during COVID that everyone got that bust of free time, free energy. And right as the marketplace, right when COVID kind of got up, people like people call them, hey, I want to sell this bike. I don't really want to do this. And they're like, well, why? I got scared, or I dropped it, or I did this.
I think what people don't realize is that you understanding how the machine actually works and what it's how it's designed to be used is so key for being able to ride.
Absolutely, it is. And we took our dual sport bikes. Judy and I, my wife and I, went up into the mountains, took our dual sport bikes. We're on this little road to Beulah, Colorado, gravel road, big chunks of gravel. It was really a mess. And she, on her XT250, was trailing brake pressure into the corner automatically. I didn't say, hey, trail brake pressure in the corner. She of course, did it on the racetrack and did it on the street. But she was trailing brake pressure in on XT250. And we were probably going between 10 and 30 miles an hour. And the reason she was doing it is she wanted that fork loaded and that tire loaded through that gravel rather than try to turn down an unloaded tire. And this unloaded tire crash, people don't talk about that enough. It's when you come into the corner, jump off the brakes, unload the tire, and fall down. And so if she wasn't trail braking, she would have to go much slower, which is fine. That's totally fine. I don't care. She would have to go much slower, or she would have dropped her bike. Now, she wouldn't have been really hurt. She had all her gear on, but she'd have dropped her bike on the left side, then she'd have dropped it on the right side. Now her XT250 is all torn up, brake levers bent, whatever else. And she's like, you know what? This isn't very much fun. I don't think I'll do this anymore. So speed has zero to do with it. It's nothing. And everybody who drives a car, truck, van, trails brake pressure into the corner. You're already doing it, folks. You're already leaving your brake lights on as you get on the freeway on-ramp in those 90-degree corners in your neighborhood. You're already doing it. You have the feel for it. Yet you arrive at a new rider school and they say, get off the brakes before you turn. And you can see the problem.
Yes.
But in England, if there truly is no training before you can buy a bike, it could arguably be safer. I've read reports that say it would be safer if you weren't instructed to not cover the brakes, because you automatically would say, well, I'm going to cover the brakes. Keith's wife, Tisha, they ride down to the beach. And he took a picture. She just jumps on her bike and she's riding along on the boardwalk where it's crowded with her fingers up on the brake levers because it makes sense. Yet she'd be told to not cover that brake lever, and you would trail brakes on a bike just like you do a car unless you're told not to. So it's time for a change, folks. We're trying from the inside. We're not getting the response that we had hoped for becoming a tier three school. We've been told things were going to happen, and then that promise was reneged on. So it's time for us to say, you know what, this is our industry, everybody. All you working at Yamaha, Honda, all the people who back the MIC and these new rider programs, it's time for us to say, we have to make these changes, and we need to make sure that new riders leave that two-day training program with true processes that will make them lifelong riders. That's the goal, create lifelong riders.
You don't start driving a car and then give up because it's, you know, giving you a few scares, because you need it. So you carry on.
Yeah, it's totally doable. I can't tell you how we had a guy show up at our school. I mean, I have so many examples, but we had this guy show up at our school, 36 years old. He bought a bike. He bought leathers. He bought gloves and boots. And he had to have it all delivered to his house because he could not ride a motorcycle. And he came to our school, and he did come to a few times. I mean, he really wanted this, and he came to, now he's qualified for four AMA nationals on a 600. So anything you want is doable if you have the desire, but you have to get the right processes. And it's not a sales pitch for our school. I mean, our school, it will get you there, but it's for the right processes. You need to find the people teaching the right processes. In Washington State, it's WMST. They are saying, you know what, we see what's happening. We want to teach this correctly. They joined with us. We combined their expertise in new riders, our expertise in motorcycle dynamics, whatever we have expertise in, and verbiage, and we put together this program. So it's totally doable. It's the dream is out there. And I got a note from a gal who got coached out, and she said, this was my dream. My dream was to buy a motorcycle, cruise around the country in my retirement. And I was told that I shouldn't ride. And it just breaks my heart. And I know that she's going to come to one of our programs, and she will be riding around the country on her motorcycle, living this dream, because she'll get the proper processes.
So who's in charge of telling these new learner schools? It must be somebody who's keeping control of the schools that are teaching the new riders.
Well, each state is allowed to put together their tests, as far as I understand, working with the SMSA. I'm pretty sure we can talk to Keith Culver about that. And they're also allowed to take any school who wants to get their curriculum approved and teach that in their state. And that's what we did with Washington State. Washington State allows other groups to come in with a new curriculum other than the two large new rider schools in the country. And that's what Washington State did. So that's the way it works. And it's a pretty good subject, isn't it? Why don't all of you who are at the MIC, Motorcycle Industry Council, who run our industry, basically, why don't you all take over these new riders tests? Why don't we make the tests realistic too? For instance, I've heard, and I'm not an expert at that, so I don't want to speak out of turn, but I've heard that one of the new riders, or one of the tests you have to pass, is a foot up U-turn, a foot on the foot pegs U-turn. And if you can't do a foot up U-turn, then you may not pass your test. What we teach at YCRS and even WMST is a foot ready U-turn. So anybody who's struggling with their U-turns, and it's oftentimes small statured people on big bikes are struggling with their U-turn, we will teach them to have their foot off the foot peg early in case they're in second gear and they stall it, in case somebody says stop, in the middle of a U-turn, car pulls out in the parking lot, their foot is off the foot peg, ready, off. It's not dragging on the ground, but it's ready, and they will save those U-turn mixes. And my wife is small, 5'3", and she said, man, when you taught me that U-turn trick, it changed everything. Now I can go down to the end of the driveway, forget my key, do a U-turn, and come back and get my key. And it wasn't a U-turn trick. It was just us thinking logically, industry. Let's just think logically. A foot up U-turn has nothing to do with riding expertise. No one's dying in a U-turn. But what happens is your sister will buy a bike. She'll drop her bike once at Denny's in the parking lot, a U-turn. No big deal. Friends pick it up. She'll do it one more time in an intersection where you're doing a U-turn to go the other way in a crowded intersection, drop her bike, stop the traffic. People jump out of their cars. They pick her bike up, put her back on, push her off. She's done. She'll be done. And she'll be done because she's trying to do a foot up U-turn. Well, we'll teach a foot ready U-turn. So that's a perfect instance of where the industry needs to step in and say, you know what? This is our industry. This is where we want to create this wonderful place to work, to be a part of. We need to take these over and take them out of the hands of bureaucrats who sit there going, let's think of a test question here. Let's do foot up U-turns because that's an expert level riding technique. We want to work on the techniques that are hurting people or having them leave the industry. So you might run across the center line two times in a downhill right-hand corner and not be killed, but you will leave the industry because it's way too scary. And you're running across the center line because you're not controlling your speed, steering geometry, and contact patch into the corner. So everybody, totally doable, and we need to step in and get with it.
So have you got any idea what we can all do about this? So for people who are listening.
We've tried to do it logically. We've tried to sit down with these people. I sat down with Tim Boucher of the MSF, and we sat over a two-hour lunch, and we came up with four things. Let's just change four things. Let's incorporate four things into new rider training. And nothing happened. It was four, five, 6 years ago. Nothing happened. Zero.
You should all write to Tim Boucher.
Well, you know, do what you want. But when you ask me that, that's actually a very good question. We should start writing letters and letting people know, especially if you truly have felt the difference. If you're a Marine who is listening to this and you came to one of our level three schools after coming to a new rider school and you felt the difference, you should write about that. And they do. But you've got to make it industry-wide. But mostly it's the industry that has to make the changes. And those of you that are representatives to the MIC, you need to understand that it might be high interest rates. It might be there's not enough new rider bikes, which I think there are. It might be that women's clothing is too expensive, which I don't think it is. My wife has bought lots of it. It might be kids don't want to risk to have any risks, but yet they're jumping skateboards and flipping bicycles. And new rider schools, don't forget, are sold out. The people that I speak to, they got sold out with a waiting list. So where's the problem? The funnel is attracting people. People want to ride motorcycles, but somewhere in that funnel of new riders, new riding techniques, they're losing interest. They're losing interest because what they learned scares them. It's not working. They're learning things that are counter to logic. When you've been riding a motocross bike all your life and you finally turn 16 and you show up at the new rider school to get your license and you're riding like this,
covering the brakes,
and they say, that's wrong. You're like, it's crazy. You would say, that's crazy. I'm not going to do this, possibly, if you have a certain personality. You got coached out. If you have a certain personality, you got coached out. You truly think you shouldn't ride when, in fact, you probably could ride really, really well. So we need, as the industry that are representatives to the MIC, we need to say, you know what? It could be all these other factors. It could also be that we're disillusioning, hurting, or killing the new members of our group because new rider schools are not quite right. They are very, very good in a lot of ways. I want to make clear that, TJ, they're very good in a lot of ways. I read through the stuff and think, boy, that's really good. But in these critical things that I would love to sit down and work with, if somebody wants to make a change, they have to be fixed. So when we do the roundtable and we discuss what's wrong with motorcycling and we get into all these topics, we need to realize we are not taking care of the new members in our sport provably. And if you give me 30 minutes of parking lot with a motorcycle, I will prove it. If you want to talk about it over the telephone without a motorcycle, I am not interested, because you can theorize all you want. You can say brake before you tip in, don't cover the brakes so you won't stab them. You can make up all this theory. But when you get on a motorcycle in a parking lot for 30 minutes or a racetrack or a street, whatever you want, I'll prove it to you.
I know for a fact that I've been taught the wrong things in the past, but new learners riding schools are fantastic. You're right. Of course, they have to be there and they give you that crucial time for learning to control your machine in a sort of a car park situation. And it's evolution, as you say. We don't walk along in front of a car with a white flag any longer. You know, it's evolution.
That's right. That's a great word. And that's what I'm all about. Evolving. I evolved my curriculum. I wrote the PACE. Remember the PACE? I wrote that back in when I was racing at Willow and riding on the street with all these class champions at Willow Springs. Enormous talent, right? But we couldn't go that fast on the street. So we came up with this PACE, and I wrote about it. And the PACE started to be taken as riding technique. It wasn't a riding technique article. It was a overall, how do you survive on the street? And it counted on not a lot of straightaway speed. So in turn, it counted on not a lot of brakes. People read it, don't use your brakes. I wrote the PACE 2.0. And I said in it, I goofed up this, everybody. I don't want you to think it's no brakes. When we're coming downhill on Stunt Road, we're using a lot of brakes because the corners are so slow. If we're up on Angeles Crest Highway, we don't use a lot of brakes because the corners are so fast, because our overall speeds are not very high. That was the main point of the story. But people read it like, oh, don't use your brakes. So I wrote the PACE 2.0 saying, absolutely, we're using our brakes, and went into it. But I said in that article, I goofed up, everybody. I didn't say this correctly, and I reset it. And that's a perfect thing. Valentino Rossi, 9-time world champion, he said, he wrote, when Mark Marquez showed up, I had to change my style. So there's a 9-time world champion who had to change his style to keep up with this new kid who revolutionized body position. Eddie Lawson in 1989, when he got on the Honda, he had to change his style. And I remember saying to him, I said, so you look a lot different on the Honda than the Yamaha. He goes, I had to change my style on the Honda, more upper body, because it didn't want to steer as well as the Yamaha, won the championship on both bikes. So all of you out there that are tied to something and believe in it and just aren't going to let go of it. Rossi did, Lawson did. We got to make these changes. I certainly did. And I tweak my curriculum every school because I just want to do it the best. I want to have best practices.
Nick's mentioning a lot of race champions and track riding, and you might be thinking, I'm never going to ride on a track and that doesn't apply to me. But let's have a listen to what Ray told me about that.
This is the only sport or recreation, I was thinking about it, that for some reason we classify racers and average day riders as different people. You know, when I take a pro lesson at my golf school, I don't go, oh, that's something the pros use because they can hit the ball 400 yards. It's the same technique that they're using to hit the ball 400 yards that I'm hitting 275 yards. But for motorcyclists, for some reason, we say, oh, that's only for the pros. You know, that's for racing. You know, like taking turns using trail braking. I hear it so much that, hey, that's only what those racers use. That's racing stuff. For some reason, this is the only sport or lifestyle that I know that classifies, hey, that dude's a professional and that's professional stuff. I'm just riding on the weekends and I don't need to know that stuff. Where this is one of the only sports I know that if I'm not doing what those professionals are doing, at least trying to understand what they're trying to do on how to control the bike and how to stop the bike, I'm going to die at this sport. I'm not going to die if my ball goes into the woods on my golf game, you know, unless it's an alligator pit or snakes, but, you know, I'm not going to get that far. And I don't know why we do that as a guy who's new to this organization or new to this group, but it seems like there's a clear distinction between, oh, that's track stuff, and this is what we do on the weekends.
Trail breaking, I was thinking, well, a lot of people might not even know what that is. It does sound like a race term, but
there's two things that trail braking allows you to do. It slows you down. It gives you speed and direction into the turn. It allows you to make a turn easier into, gives you the bike controls. And, you know, the only two controls we have in a turn is our lean and our braking. And lean is risk. The more I lean the bike over, the more I'm at jeopardy of sliding or having an accident. So I want to use my controls that I have, that the engineers have produced for us, to control the bike better, and that is using trail brake to slow my entry speed. And then with tire loaded, I can work the tire and then I can turn the bike easier into the corner.
So by trail braking, you're talking about keeping your brakes on while you go into a turn or a bend.
Yes, and then giving away some of the braking as you're starting to make your turn. The biggest thing is getting the bike in the right direction and at the appropriate speed that you want to be at when you're going through a turn.
That's interesting. That's already a couple of things you told me from what you learned to start with. So keep covering your brakes, basically, being prepared.
Anytime you come to a place where your stomach is a little nauseous or, hey, you know by the stats that these are where people are dying, you know, that's where you want to roll onto your brakes.
Right.
Have them covered because if I'm running like I was taught at MSF class with not covering my brakes and not having an on the throttle, well, that half a second, and I would say that half a second is somebody who is young, have perfect eyesight and perfect reaction set. Me is probably more like a second to notice that, hey, there's a car pulling out in front of me and now I got to do something if I'm sitting on the throttle. So at a half a second, they say it's 66 feet. At 57 or 58 years old, not having a 20-year-old eyesight, it might be a second. So that's 124 feet. That's through the intersection. That's on the other side of the intersection. So the quicker I can react and have my fingers in a position to react, I'm not going to be apt to stab, jab, or slam the brakes. I'm going to gently be able to put on the front brake and use my back brake as well if needed to bring the bike to a complete stop. And it's not always about going fast or going at speeds. It's about stopping at speeds. So they have a drill where you ride at speed and you have to bring the bike to a complete stop. You know, natural life situations. I am a cheerleader for Champ School. Because, you know, it did save my life probably. But, you know, when you go to the classes and you're sitting there with the Harley engineers or the engineers from other manufacturers or the the sales guys and the business development guys and all the guys who are responsible in the motorcycle industry for these bikes, you know, and you listen to what Champ School is talking about, and they defer and they ask these engineers, hey, is this correct? And they all nod their head, yes. And it's an eye-opening event, eye-opening, you know, class when you're sitting in there and they go, hey, you know, is the bike made to do this? And, you know, engineers from Harley go, yes. You go, wow, even Harleys are made to do this. So a bike, and this is what I try to tell my friends, the bike doesn't know whether it's on the track, your local road, or touring. The bike's engineered to do what the bike is engineered to do by some of the best engineers in the world. Why not ride it like it's been made to ride?
Well, exactly. I think that you do benefit greatly from knowing how a motorcycle is designed to be ridden.
The industry needs to jump in and take over the testing, get this new rider school stuff correct, really get after it, because we have people coming into the sport. And TJ, I'm not a fan of everybody riding. I'm not a fan. In fact, I'm not a fan of the Marine Corps offering free rider training, because free rider training, oh, you're sitting there doing something and your buddy says, hey, there's free motorcycle rider training next Saturday. Oh, okay. And so you go do it, but you don't have the passion for it. I'm not a fan of that. I'm not a fan. I think you have to have skin in the game. You have to pay. You have to think about it. You got to want it. You got to put your time and effort in and money. So I'm not saying everybody should ride. I'm saying people who show a desire, who come to these schools, have to get the right message.
I think everybody should ride.
It's the best, isn't it? It's the highest highs.
If everybody rode for a short period, yeah, it would make riding safer on the roads for a lot of motorcyclists.
I agree. Yes, I agree.
But that's a different subject.
Yes, it is. And, you know, there's some off-spins of some of these ideas. Unfortunately, the ranges at some of these new rider schools limit speeds. And if a rider leaves the new rider school stopping only from 22 miles an hour, 24 miles an hour, whatever else it is, that's not enough. And so, oh, now Nick is saying we got to repave our ranges. Well, it's something to think about, isn't it? Because when's the last time you rode at 24 miles an hour and truly had much of an emergency? It's when we're up in the freeway speeds, et cetera. So that's a thought. Also, I'm not a big fan of the way braking is taught. There's a much better process to teach braking. So, you know, there's a lot of things out there on the table that could be tweaked. And I'm mostly concerned with riding technique. And I know that at the Marine Corps programs, we will find a spot somewhere around the course, even if it's on a road we can close, where the Marines are stopping from 60, 70 miles an hour. Because one of the things that will really help riders control their speeds is stopping from those speeds. So you stop your bike a couple times from 80 miles an hour, and all of a sudden you're like, you know what? This takes a long time to stop the bike. I better not be going 80 into situations I can't see. So that's a perfect example of some of the tweaks that we are trying to make.
Yes, I have to admit, when I did the Yamaha Champions Riding School, that's the first time I'd ridden on a track. And the freedom it gave me mentally to know that there was no traffic and it was a big wide road and you could go fast, and fast by my standards, and learn to stop from speeds and get the feel of speed somewhere that is that safe. I think that was an excellent part of just the whole experience.
It is. And, you know, these four riders that I talked about earlier that got coached out, asked, told to leave, you couldn't ride, they would have never gotten this experience to come to a school like ours or work with some of these top coaches, you know, the Pridmores, the Hayes's, DeSalvo. I mean, I'm sure I'm leaving some out, but these riders that are teaching the correct things because they do the correct things. Those four riders would never have gotten a chance to do what you did, which is show up at another school on a track and maybe find a world that they love. And maybe they start doing track days and they go racing, and now they're buying tires every weekend. And I mean, the industry growth that's available by keeping the interested people is beyond what I can say, because you never know how many bikes. Ray Hammonds bought 100 motorcycles. Because he has the wherewithal and the interest to do that.
Yeah, he's built his business and he's got to a stage in life where he's enjoying his income, and he's found the joy of motorcycling. And once, now that he's there, he's keeping the motorcycle industry floating by the sounds of it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, great guy.
But joking aside, yes, we do not want to lose people who've got the desire, basically, because they can be taught.
Oh, I see it every day. I believe in it. It's, you know, I wasn't on with you 10 years ago with this message. 10 years ago, I was like, yeah, you know what? Everybody's trying. Everybody's interested in growing the sport. I really felt that people were really trying. And now I'm not seeing that anymore. I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing people trying. When we come to someone who's in charge and we say, this isn't correct, it's not working, it's not the way the bike is designed to be ridden, and nothing changes, it's time to say, you know what, industry, come on, let's go. But this is our life. And, you know, if you think to yourself, well, I don't really agree with this, well, just do this. Just turn on any, get on YouTube. Perfect way to do it is get on YouTube and look up Valentino Rossi. And just watch, he has a yellow glove. You know, he's retired now, but he has a yellow glove. Watch him trail brake pressure down in the corner. Watch him turn in and trail off. You see his glove come off the brakes as he adds lean angle. He's trading brake pressure for lean angle points, trading off brake pressure. It's called trail braking. Just watch him do that. And then you think to yourself, well, gosh, he's not on a street bike on the street. He's on a racetrack and on a brand new bike. Well, then pick up Kenny Roberts' book in 1985. When he wrote the book, he said, if you let go of the brakes before you turn in, your chassis, he wrote it a little bit differently. The chassis comes up and the bike wants to run straight on. He wrote it with a British rider. So back in 85, Robert said, if you let go of the brake before you turn, the chassis comes up, the bike wants to run straight on. So everybody, come on, we got to get with it. We've been the best in the world, have been doing these things right from the get-go. And guess who gets asked about bike design? The people who win championships. Roger Hayden won 2 championships with Kawasaki. 2 times he was flown to Japan, downloaded with the engineers for a week at a time on what he did to his bike to win the national championship in America, which was the biggest money back then, the most important national championship in the 600s. So here's the kid who won the championship, flown to Japan to talk about how to design our next street bike, not our next race bike, our next street bike to work better based on what you found in your seasons, Roger. And I can go on and on. I often do, but I'm letting y'all know that it's totally provable, it's totally tieable, and it's time for us to say, you know what? The new rider industry is not keeping up with where we want to be, and it's time to say, let's get with them, let's work with them, let's help them, like we're doing with WMST. Let's get with them, let's produce better riders. We produce better riders in 2 days. They buy more motorcycles, they ride longer, they become just like you've become running motorcycle magazines. They get involved with the industry because they're not running across the center line. They're not having continuous emergencies. Do you understand, riders and industry, when you're riding like this through traffic or in a parking lot or on a road that has deer ready to jump out, when you're riding like this, everything's an emergency. Everything's an emergency. And if you think to yourself, no, Nick, they don't have to do that. They're covering the rear brake, go into a parking lot, and do a stop from 60 miles an hour rear brake only, and do a stop from 60 miles an hour front brake only, and you'll find out why the rear brake is such a joke to depend on. So there, this is provable, this is doable. It's time for us to step up, everybody. We gotta step up and say, this is something we need to do. I am. I know we'll ruffle feathers, I know we will, but I want things to change because I wanna do this for a lot longer. I'm still young. Still got plenty of years in the deal. I want Champion School to grow. I want your magazine to grow. I want my dealer to sell more tires. I want Honda to sell more bikes. I want to do this. And one of the ways to do it is to get that funnel opened up. So when they come into the funnel, they shoot right through to become a really good motorcycle rider.
And when you are the new rider, you have no idea.
Especially certain personalities. You know, if you're a 17-year-old girl, and you show up there with a certain personality, you're used to kind of being just listening to what people say.
I'm not 17, but I'm a real do as you're told sort of a person. And I was told to do it. And I did. And I think, as I said to you, that's where I ended up gripping the grips. And Freddie said to me, you know, these are your delicate instruments, kind of let go and use them.
Yes, good.
Because we were told not to cover the brakes because we'd have failed.
I know, you'd have been failed. You've been failed out. The instructors are instructed to fail you out for covering your brakes.
Yes.
I did speak with Nick Mathurin, who was my coach, who went to that parking lot with that Diego kid. But Diego wrote to him, and he said, thank you for giving me my dream. I mean, he literally wrote that in the text. Thank you for giving me my dream.
Yes. Let the evolution begin.
Come on.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.